Hi, this is Bob Scheer with Scheer Intelligence, and I'm really fortunate today to have Jill Stein, who has run for public office as a Green candidate, and probably many people know her, having gotten the most votes any woman candidate for president has ever gotten, even though it was 0.3% of the votes when you ran last time. But right now, let me just begin with Harvard. And you were there, at, I believe, in 69. And tell me how you came to be a Green Party candidate rather than the head of the AMA or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or on the board of Davos, where I think the board is dominated by Harvard graduates right now, of the World Economic Forum. You know, the rich and powerful and the corporations of the world are meeting and, you know, continuing to corporatize our future and render democracy irrelevant, you know. And so when I get introduced as a Harvard grad, I usually ask people, please don't hold it against me. You know, I was in Harvard at the time of the occupation of University Hall, where the protests were raging against the Vietnam War, and we actually shut down the university, and we had a people's university for many weeks, and that's how we closed out, I think, my freshman year. So I didn't have your usual Harvard experience. But, you know, I will say it's really, it's kind of emblematic of what's happening to higher education as well as to our economy, the way that Harvard and other institutions have really become now extreme servants of the economic elite. So, you know, how did I get from there to here, you know, like what's a nice doctorate like you like running for office?
How you became a nice doctor, because after all, it was Lawrence Summers, the head of Harvard, who said women aren't particularly good at science and we shouldn't expect it. And clearly you went from a liberal arts undergraduate to become a successful and highly respected doctor. How do you view Lawrence's comments in that?
He's sort of a really unfortunate symbol of what so much of Harvard has become. When I was there in the late 60s and the early 70s, it was a very different place. There was a thriving women's movement there. It was the point where Radcliffe, you know, the women's college integrated with Harvard, and there was a feeling that, you know, we are taking on the world and ain't nothing going to stop us. And it was an era of incredible empowerment. And for me, it was a huge transition from kind of the mindset of the 50s and 60s and sort of the suburban mode of privilege, really American exceptionalism and privilege. But all that, you know, began to unravel in a big way with the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement and the turmoil of the assassination of Martin Luther King. So, you know, it was really quite a great awakening. And, you know, that was really my, you know, that's what really molded my sense of community and responsibility and social change. And I was very much wedded to that, really even before I got to Harvard. But my experience there just solidified that.
You know, it's interesting. I happened to speak at Harvard, I think, a year or 2 years before you were a freshman. And I was a guest of the Kennedy Center, as was Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense. And the demand of the demonstrators of Harvard SDS was that he debate me. I was the editor of Ramparts magazine, which was, played a leading role in criticizing the war. And I would have thought, you know, we wouldn't be in that kind of situation this many years now, where we're defending really idiotic wars that make the problems much worse, and you have blowback and all the things Chomsky and others have written about eloquently. Why do they still support stupid wars? Why is there so much indifference to income inequality? It's just startling. Why is it such a center of privilege? After all, this Harvard, just like USC, where we're recording this, started as basically religious institutions with at least some reference to everyone having a soul and the worth of every individual life.
For me, as a medical doctor, how I got actually politicized, because, you know, it was kind of an easy step to go from Harvard to going into medicine, and that was kind of like a very expected thing to do. But what was very challenging was to go from medicine into political action. And I, you know, the way I explain that in a nutshell is that I used to practice clinical medicine, taking care of patients. Now I practice political medicine because it's the mother of all illnesses. And literally, if we're going to fix the things that are actually killing us, we need to fix the corrupt and failing political system. I got recruited early on by parents and communities to be a doctor advocate for communities that were fighting against things that are making our kids sick. So I began to work with Physicians for Social Responsibility, Clean Water Action, Toxics Action Center, and so on, these groups that were actually trying to change these engines of our destruction around us. And I became involved in shutting down incinerators and cleaning up coal plants and protecting kids from mercury exposure and stuff like that. And I found that in spite of having really good solutions, like creating more jobs in recycling centers or in energy conservation and weatherization, you know, we could offer solutions that would create more jobs, be better for the economy, be terrific for our health, and protect the environment. But that didn't matter. You know, the bottom line was what kind of money you were bringing to the legislators, to the elected officials. So we got together, built a broad coalition, passed campaign finance reform and public financing in Massachusetts. And it was the Democratic legislature, 85% Democratic. They could have passed any law and overridden any veto. They wouldn't touch it. We passed it as a referendum by a huge margin, a 2-to-1 margin, and they repealed it on a voice vote. And it was right around that time that I was tricked into running for office for the first time by the Greens, who came and said, "We buy your agenda. Just run for governor and, you know, call that your political campaign," which I was foolish enough to believe, thinking that, you know, I could just do that and run for office. It's different from that. I never would have taken that step had I not been kind of fooled into it. But having taken it, discovered there was so much public hunger out there for a real conversation, for, you know, for someone who didn't look like a rat and talk like a rat and smell like a rat. People are busy. They don't have time to research, you know, the details, but they can tell if you're on the take. And green politics really appealed to people so much that when we fought our way into a televised debate, and this was running for governor against Mitt Romney in 2002, we fought our way into a debate because the demonstrations were huge and people were irate that real human beings were being locked out of the debate. We got in. I articulated the usual green agenda of greening our energy system and our economy, living wage jobs, cutting the military, putting our resources back into true security at home. Healthcare is a human right. You know, the usual litany. It went over like a lead balloon inside the TV studio with just the candidates and the moderator. Nobody even bothered to rebut those ideas. But when we walked out, I was mobbed by the press for the first time and the last time, because they've since been otherwise instructed. They told me that I had won the debate on the instant online viewer poll. And for me, that was the revealing moment. And I realized we are not the lunatic fringe, as the political establishment would have us believe. This is really where the values and the vision of the American people are. But it's a political system which is thoroughly hijacked and corrupted by big money that's got a stranglehold around the two political parties.
Oh, this is Bob Scheer talking to Jill Stein. Truly an American original, about something that doesn't seem so promising right now, the Green Party campaign for presidency. You're not even officially the candidate yet. You have to win that. And I do want to talk to you about, what is the Green Party? How can it be built? How can it be, you know, become a part of American political life that is, you have to take seriously? But before we get that, certainly when you were running last time, the presence of Bernie Sanders was not complicating the situation. And much of what you've just said, Bernie Sanders has said. There isn't really that much difference between what you stand for and what Bernie does, except on one point, and I discussed it with Ralph Nader in a previous podcast, and that was his decision to say he will support the candidate of the Democratic Party. And so one has the prospect, if he loses, and if he loses, it'll be because these debates are rigged. They're held at times where nobody can watch them or will watch them, and money will talk and so forth. But the fact is that since he made that commitment, your time may really come with a vengeance, unfortunately. You know, if it is Hillary, you will have a much cleaner line to demand an accounting and a voice be heard. And so how do you feel now during this period? What is your view of Bernie Sanders? What is your view of how we get from here to November?
We have a lot in common. Where we differ is more on foreign policy and on the role of the military. But we have so many things in common, basically on our agenda for economic justice. Domestically, you know, there are fine points. We support canceling student debt. We're the only campaign that will stand up for that. And that, by the way, addresses 43 million young people and not so young people who are locked into debt.
Now, well, you've called them indentured servants.
That's actually right, because they are, you know, and the jobs that are available are not sufficient to keep a roof over their head, let alone also pay back their debt. Now, if those 43 million people alone heard that they could come out in November and cancel their debt by voting green, we will win the election, regardless of who's running, because for the Democrats. So, you know, I just want to say that there is potentially a path to victory. Am I holding my breath? No. Am I ruling it out? I'm not ruling it out. We need to build to where we have a politics that is of, by, and for the people, that's capable of creating jobs. I wish we had a system that could elect Bernie Sanders in the Democratic Party. I don't believe the Democrats will allow it. They've demonstrated they have a kill switch. It's not just the money in politics. They, you know, changed their structure so they have Super Tuesdays and they have super delegates. And Hillary is rapidly, you know, monopolizing those superdelegates. So even if they go into the nominating convention with Bernie ahead, Hillary will still win it. And they also have their smear campaigns, which they have used over and over again for, you remember Howard Dean and the Dean Scream when he was doing very well. They sabotaged him with a PR smear campaign. They did the same thing to Jesse Jackson.
So let me just go back to something you said before, your own disagreements with Bernie. And you mentioned foreign policy. What are your disagreements?
For example, Bernie has said that the solution to our involvement in the Middle East is to let the Saudis get their hands dirty, you know, let the Saudis do the work for us. Well, unfortunately, we've been partnering with the Saudis in creating this mess from the get-go. You know, Bernie supports the F-35 weapon system, for example, because it brings jobs to his state and many other states. You know, it's a total boondoggle.
Universal stealth bomber.
Yes,
fighter,
which is a very fallible bomber to start with. I don't know, it can't fly in, you know, cloudy weather or something, or it's detectable on, you know, World War II era radar. You know, so it's a boondoggle even before it's off the production line. It's cost almost $1 trillion. It will cost another half before it's done. This is not where our tax dollars should go. We support a foreign policy based on international law, human rights, and diplomacy, and not fighting these wars for oil, which in fact we have the power to stop. We have the power to essentially stop ISIS in its tracks and to, you know, to participate in this public delusion that we're going to fix ISIS by dropping more bombs and bullets on ISIS. That's what created ISIS. Hello, what do you think we spent $6 trillion over the last 14 years on? Killed over 1 million Iraqis, lost tens of thousands of Americans killed or maimed, and we're going to do more of this and expect it to work? What new resources exactly are we going to bring to the table that's going to pummel, you know, the terrorists out of this? The problem is we have a direct conduit to the Saudis. We've sold them over $50 billion worth of weapons in the last 5 years alone. The Saudis are then a conduit to any terrorist group that happens to be their terrorist du jour. The Saudis' own Wahhabism has basically inspired international terrorism. We and the Saudis created the Mujahideen, which led to Al-Qaeda, which then led to ISIS, and it's now a global movement. So we don't need to do this anymore. We need a peace offensive is what we're calling for, not more war, whether it's at the hands of the Saudis or the hands of the U.S. So that's where we differ from Bernie.
Yeah, but I think Bernie would probably accept most of what you just said. But the
I don't know. He says directly contrary to that.
Well, let me bring up a third rail issue
That
some people have brought up about Bernie, and that's Israel.
There you go.
And some people have asked me, because they knew I was going to interview you, what is your position, and are you willing to talk about Israel in any kind of critical
way? I actually
do
talk about Israel quite a bit, and I often talk about it in the same breath as Saudi Arabia, because we need a consistent policy where we are not carving out exceptions for certain kinds of war criminals and tyrants, whether they're Saudis or whether it's Netanyahu. We need a international policy based on international law and human rights and diplomacy. So that means we don't supply Israel with $8 million a day to conduct its war crimes against, against Palestine, period. And same thing for Egypt. You know, they don't get $3 billion a year either, and we don't sell weapons to the Saudis.
But let me take it back to domestic issues and your unquestioned expertise, not that you're not expert in all these other things, certainly as much as anybody running for president, but on the medical issue and the question of health care. And you wrote an article with a fellow physician that we published in Truthdig, I think a very important article, taking issue with the debate between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton on health care. And the reason I found that important was that many of the people I run into tell me they can't effectively, in fact, a couple of my own children, effectively use the healthcare system because the deductibles are too high, the costs are too high, and so forth. Yes. And it's all about cost, and that nothing was done either under Hillary's original plan, under Romney's plan, or under this plan to really hold back cost. And that was sort of a point of your article. So let's speak a little bit about healthcare.
What we need to expand is Medicare for All, which can be expanded really in the blink of an eye. We can move to a very simple and streamlined system. We can take the profiteering out of healthcare, and we can make healthcare a human right and join the community of developed nations that is already doing this at half the cost or less of what we're paying, with far better health outcomes by simply doing that. So administratively, it's simple. It saves so much money by streamlining this complex private health insurance bureaucracy. By streamlining that with a Medicare for All, simple single-payer system, we save so much money that we can cover everyone and cover you completely, so that health care is essentially free at the point of use. And we pay for it progressively through the tax base. But for, I think the statistics are something like 90% of Americans, we save an enormous amount of money because we're paying for health care and health insurance through the teeth right now in so many ways, including outrageous skyrocketing premiums and co-pays and so on.
But isn't that pretty much what Bernie says?
And in fact, our article says that Bernie is on target.
Yeah.
His latest plan, which he just released before the last debate, is what was needed, which is, well, actually, he hasn't filed legislation for it yet, but it has the characteristics of the bill that's in the House, this so-called H.R. 676. The one place we differ from Bernie on health care is by defending the Affordable Care Act, or saying that we're going to build on the Affordable Care Act, because that's the mythology that the health insurance system uses, that we can grow our way incrementally to a single-payer system. And you can't. You really have to kiss it goodbye and expand Medicare in one fell swoop, which can be done very quickly and efficiently.
But let me assume that Bernie is going not to make it because of the role of money, power, superdelegates, and all the things. And that, in fact, you're going to have what Ralph Nader predicts, a disillusioned group of people, particularly younger people, who put a lot of faith in Bernie. Because, by the way, on all the points of difference between you and Bernie Sanders, I suspect a good talking to with his staff would probably find a lot of agreement on these. And then, you know.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
All right. So you're saying I don't want to have to go back over the tape. You're saying definitely and for sure, right?
That our agenda and Bernie's agenda mostly overlap. We have so much more in common relative to the differences between my campaign and Bernie's campaign with Hillary.
So on the question of Hillary, what I hear a lot of is two things. I hear how important it is to break the glass ceiling and that we finally have a woman. And secondly, I get a lot of giving Hillary a bye on certain on really important issues, like her support of Bill Clinton's welfare reform or her support of wars even worse than Bill Clinton. Or I mean, I could go through the litany, and yet it's the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court. Or she really loves children, or she's really one of us, or it's really important to have a woman, and it is. And then I suggest, yes, but what if that woman is really Margaret Thatcher, which is how I happen to see Hillary Clinton? Then, you know, you get the pushback. So how do you deal with the pushback as a strong woman, and I assume a feminist? How do you handle the Hillary question?
I encourage people, you know, to really look at the facts and look at the record. You know, Hillary is full of talk, but, you know, who's gotten more money from, you know, Goldman Sachs and the banks, and even her policies on banking? You know, she won't support Glass-Steagall. She won't, you know, and her husband repealed it, and she, you know, has supported those policies on war. She didn't just support the war policies. You know, she led the charge as Secretary of State into the disaster of Libya. And she supported the, you know, the charge into Iraq and the disaster that came out of that. So, you know, if you actually get beyond the propaganda to what Hillary's track record is, she's been, you know, on the wrong side, I'd say most of the time. And that when she does stand up, it's on, you know, it's on marginal, you know, it's more, you know, like she'll support childcare, or she'll support, you know, parental leave or something like that. But she won't, like, support a decent wage. You know, she'll support equal wages for women, but not decent wages for everybody, you know, to start with.
Well, so, let me go further, since this is a conversation as well as an interview. I happened to cover Bill Clinton a bit at the end when he was governor of Arkansas. I interviewed him when he ran for president. And he and Hillary were talking about a program called Project Success and their welfare reform, and advocating ending welfare as we know it. And there's been no program that has done more damage to poor women. You know, 70% of the people on welfare were children, aides to families dependent children. They ended the major federal anti-poverty program, came in with a you know, targeted, so-called targeted program that very much reduced support, left decision-making up to the tender mercies of the states with no federal adult supervision of how this was done. And it's been a disaster. And it isn't discussed in this election, something I would expect your campaign might raise as an issue, because it really cuts to the class component of the feminism. You know, what do we care about the most vulnerable women in the society? And, you know, I was shocked that Planned Parenthood would break its tradition, or at least one branch of Planned Parenthood that's allowed to endorse, and endorse Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders, who's certainly much better on all these issues as far as the well-being of women, poor women.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a testimony to how you know, how inside the box now the many of the major nonprofits have become, you know, and the same is true for many of the large unions and so on, that they're, you know, they're mostly staying the course. And they've also been talked into this lesser evil mindset where they settle for crumbs because they've been told to settle for crumbs. So let me address that broader issue, because I think it applies to those who are celebrating Hillary without really looking at her record, and without recognizing that their own lives have been devastated. You know, I mean, household wealth has crashed by 40% in the last 10 years. And remember, Obama had two houses of Congress that were Democrat while he bailed out the banks to the tune of $16 trillion, according to the General Accounting Office. You know, he makes George Bush look like a wimp if you actually compare a policy by policy, whether you look at the expanding wars, the attack on our civil liberties, the deportation and vilification of immigrants, you know, NAFTA, and now the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Hillary Clinton has also, you know, been a proponent of until she recently became a convert, at least, you know, for the purpose of this election. You know, the record of Democrats is terrible, and our lives have been seriously put in jeopardy, whether you look at the economics of our survival, you know, if you are an immigrant facing deportation, if you're an undocumented American, if you are, you know, an African-American, you know, talking about, you know, the legacy of the Clinton administration. How about, you know, what was it called? The omnibus crime bill, you know, the three strikes, you're out, you know, the creation and the worsening of this war on drugs, which is a war on African-Americans, the militarization of our police and police brutality, the housing crisis and the homelessness, which just, you know, just exploded under Obama. And he chose to bail out the banks, you know, rather than bailing out the homeowners or holding the banks accountable. So it's really important to actually look at the record and not the rhetoric. And that's how I deal with it. I encourage people to actually look at what happened to try to get above the propaganda.
I'm talking to Jill Stein, who's potentially the Green Party candidate. You haven't sewed it up yet, but people think you're the front runner, so that's fine. But, you know, in Germany, when the Greens came along, there was room for them to operate and grow and actually become part of a coalition government at some point, because you have proportional representation to a degree. And if you get more than 5% of the vote, you get 5% of the seats or something in the Bundestag. And so for all of our proclamation being the center of representative government in the United States, aside from the Electoral College and the role of money in Citizens United and everything, we also have laws that both parties favor that prevent someone like Ralph Nader or Jill Stein from getting on the ballot. Now, first of all, how are the Greens doing? Where will people be able to vote for you in the general if you get the nomination? What is the Green Party?
So the Greens are a, you know, an American party, and we're also an international party. And we have that point of view. You know, when the astronauts were up there looking back at planet Earth, you know, that did a lot to stimulate social change and the environmental movement and political change. And it was around that time that the Greens were formed in response to nuclear disasters, actually, in Germany is where the Greens came out of. And they were, you know, advocating for clean, renewable energy, in part in response to the dangers of nuclear energy. In Europe, they, because they have a multi-party system, the Greens have enabled Europe by challenging the establishment. They have really been able to move things along. So they're way ahead of us on green energy and on sustainable economies and things like that. In this country, Greens have held hundreds of offices at the local and county level, mayors, city councilors, and so on. We are now working on ballot access. Independent parties have to fight their way on every election. We are ahead of where we were 4 years ago. 4 years ago, we were on the ballot for almost 85% of voters. We also have two court cases now suing the Commission on Presidential Debates, which the League of Women Voters has called a fraud being perpetrated on the American voters, because it's a private corporation, basically, that restricts debate.
I know, and it used to be that the League of Women Voters was the organization that sponsored the debates.
And they should be.
And now it's left up to Fox TV or CNN.
And the parties themselves.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so here the Democrats have been basically able to make the debates relatively unimportant to the selection of Hillary Clinton, because Bernie was a threat, or anybody else. So come November, if it's a Hillary versus whoever race, and you're going to be on the ballot in 85%?
We hope 100%. You know, the latest Wall Street Journal poll, and this goes back to the summer, showed that 21% of American adults are now identify as Republicans. 21%, that's a minority party. 29% identify as Democrats, and 50% have rejected them both. So while there's interesting struggles going on within each of the parties, there are a lot of people out there who basically don't buy it anymore, who don't care about the rhetoric and really see what the results are. And they're looking for something different, including those 43 million young people and not so young people who are indentured servants with student debt with no way out, even under a Sanders policy. So if word gets out to people who really have a stake in this game that they can fix it. In fact, one of our, you know, realizations is that the lesser evil, unfortunately, keeps paving the way to the greater evil. Because when the lesser evil is just one step shy of awful, people don't come out to vote, you know, and that's what happened in 2014. That's not the case with Bernie. There would be a lot of enthusiasm there. But with Hillary, you know, or other Democratic candidates, the candidates that are likely to be supported by the Democratic Party and get the nomination are lesser evil candidates that are not going to bring out the vote.
What is radical about this? I mean, now they're even describing Bernie Sanders is radical, and he even uses the word revolution. We need a revolution. Yeah, you need a revolution if by that you mean you're going to get rid of the power of big money to control everything. Yeah, that's the kind of revolution the founders had in mind. But if you think about what is common sense, what is obviously true, what obviously needs to be done, clearly the kind of health care that you're advocating is the common sense conservative position. Right? I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's so, and just, you know, again, looking at your trajectory of great success as a student, as a scholar, as a doctor, you know, able to, you know, this is a difficult terrain to climb, to get to be, you know, a graduate of Harvard and Harvard Medical School and all these things. What is your short answer to
how you
keep going?
You know, I feel like I'm incredibly privileged to be able to do this. And that my struggle as a candidate is small potatoes compared to the struggle of African Americans who are just trying to walk down the street, you know, or immigrants who've been forced to migrate here by the crisis we created, the U.S. government created through NAFTA, through our drug wars that have killed 100,000 people in Mexico, you know, through our military invasions. And they've come here, and now they're criminalized, and they're locked up, and then they're going to be sent back to the death squads in El Salvador. I mean, to me, the plight of growing numbers of people, and add to that, you know, the economic plight, which is like people are barely keeping their heads above water, or young people who really put their best feet forward, and they did their best, they studied hard, they worked hard, they got their degree, and now they're saddled with this predatory debt, and they don't have a job, you know, and they've got this mortgage to pay just starting off in life, but no house to show for it, and, you know, and no job. So, you know, I feel like this is the responsibility of those of us who have the capacity to struggle. This is an all hands on deck moment. And what I find really encouraging is that when we have stood up and stood together as a broad coalition for justice, we win, you know, and we have done this. We stopped the FCC from privatizing the internet. We have stopped the Trans-Pacific Partnership from passing thus far, and we forced it into an election year, which is going to really tilt the tables against it. You know, we have had many victories. We stopped the war in Syria in 2012 when it was a done deal. Forget it, you know, don't question it. So we have power. This is the time to use it. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, it's only for the good that we're able to do this now. And we have a really magical moment where we can turn the breaking point that we're facing into the tipping point for the peaceful, just, green future we deserve. We got to do it now.
Thank you, Jill Stein. And I'm sure we'll have you back between now and November. That's it for another edition of our podcast, Share Intelligence. My guest has been Jill Stein, a potential Green Party candidate for president. Our producers are Joshua Shear and Rebecca Mooney, Sebastian Grubar at USC at the Annenberg School was the recording engineer on this show, and Mario Diaz as well at KCRW. See you next time.